Right, so this is a talk about something completely different. And so I'm still also working in DNS, but I thought I'd talk about something else, transport through single molecules. I will first give some motivation and talk about what to expect on physical grounds for transport through single molecules, and show a few experiments which are relevant and discuss a few more specific theoretical results. This is the canonical Moore's law slide. It shows that the number of processors in a number of transistors in a single processor chip has increased exponentially over 35 years. And it's obvious that if you extrapolate that, then the features on a chip will soon become the size of a single molecule, a small one, but of course that's very naive extrapolation. More interestingly is that molecular electronics is also attractive because you can use chemical processes to build larger components out of smaller molecules. For example, you could grow these blue and greenish components by whatever chemical processes, and then have this kind of chemical transition bind them together. And you see that you cannot have two blue ones or two green ones bind together. That doesn't work. But of course, this particular reaction here is very simple, and it doesn't scale up. You have many different components, and you want to address them such that only component A binds to component Z and not to something else. And one way that has been demonstrated that works is to attach short pieces of DNA to the components, and they bind together when these two the sequences match. This, as I said, this has in fact been really done experimentally, and they don't bind if they don't match. So in that case, you can attach address labels to the molecular components, and that's of course a nicely scalable method. This figure here is meant to show that people are studying specific molecules for use as certain components of molecular electronics, like wires, switches, rectifiers, and memory devices here. And from the physics point of view, a switch and a memory device is more or less the same, of course, because both should have two at least data stable configurations and should retain that configuration for a sufficiently long time. So both can function in two different ways. They could be two different conformations of the molecule. This is this example. There's the ring closing, ring opening transition here. Or there could be a local magnetic moment which switches between up and down. In both cases, you want at some point to read out this information stored by the conformation or the spin, and to do that you want to pass a current through the molecule, because you want to interface that molecular electronics with the standard electronics. So you want electronic readout and also a possible electronic writing to switch the molecule into a certain predefined state. So this motivates why people are studying electronic tunneling through molecules. Now, it's of course not easy to make electric contacts to a single molecule. Several groups have managed that by now. It's usually done by mechanical break junction or electromigration technique, and they both work something like this. You have a thin metallic wire with a weak spot here, and then you break that wire by either bending the whole sample or by passing a current through this wire. So and then it breaks at this weak spot, and you deposit molecules in solution onto that, and if you are lucky, you end up with a molecule sitting between the tips. Of course, in many cases, you don't have one between the tips, or you have more than one between the tips. So people usually make 100 or so samples and select those which seem to have a single molecule between the tips. And it's then a matter of debate sometimes whether that's really the case. So one has to be careful in interpretation of the results. And also in the electromigration technique, it's possible to use the substrate here as a gate electrode. So it's isolated from these two contacts. You can apply a voltage to the gate electrode, and that shifts the energy levels of the molecule, somewhat like in the quantum dot. And also like in a quantum dot, this is what you typically see. And I would like to explain that just qualitatively. You see the current, this is the current as a function of the bias voltage between the two tips. And you see steps in the current, and at small bias you see often no current or a very small current. Now if you don't plot the current but the derivative, the I over dV, which is the differential conductance, then these steps here correspond to peaks. And these are plotted here as these bright lines. The bias voltage is now upward, and the other axis is the gate voltage applied to this substrate gate. And that voltage shifts the energy level, as I said, and due to that, these steps or peaks also shift. Now, why are there these steps in the first place? At small bias voltage here, we can have this situation. Bias voltage means there's a difference in the chemical potential between the left and right leads, but in this case it's not, the energy of the electrons here in the left lead is not high enough to excite the molecule or to get another electron out of the molecule. Let's say the relevant transition of the molecule is between state with one electron and two electrons. Could also be 0 and 1, 5 and 6, that doesn't matter. So in this case, no current is flowing to the first approximation. And that's Coulomb blockade, because this energy cost for the electron to turn onto the molecule is partially due to the Coulomb repulsion between that electron and the electrons already present. And that's the same physics as which is also seen in artificial quantum dots. Now, as you increase the bias, at some point the energy of the electrons in the left lead is large enough to tunnel onto the molecule, and then they can tunnel out again on the other side, and so you have a current. And the current doesn't depend on the bias in this range, because you have just one channel, and you need electrons formed with this energy, which matches with this, to tunnel onto it. So there's only one conduction channel. Now, what's that second step here? For even higher bias, you can have this situation. Now you can have the same process as before, but you can have another one, which is an electron tunnels onto the molecule, and there loses energy to some local mode, some local excitation, which could be a vibration of the molecule or could be a spin flip, and then tunnels out. So that's an inelastic tunneling process because the electron loses some of its energy. Now you have two channels and you have higher current. So all that was for the case of weak coupling between the tips and the molecule, which is the only case I'm going to talk about. And it was sequential tunneling. That just means lowest order perturbation theory. Now, if you look carefully at that range here of the Coulomb blockade regime, where previously I've drawn zero current, then you find that the current is not really zero, but it's small. And in this regime, the current is at least piecewise linear in the bias voltage. So that means that the differential conductance now is constant. And there are these kinks in the current, the differential conductance has a step. So now the steps are in the differential conductance and not in the current. And both are much smaller than in the previous regime. So what's that? In this regime, as I said, we don't have any direct any energy, any transitions of the molecules in the energy range between the chemical potentials of the leads. So the direct process is not possible, but we have some transition up here, for example. So what can happen is there can be a coherent tunneling process from the left lead through a virtual excitation of the molecule to the right lead, all in one process. That's obviously higher in higher order in the tunneling amplitude. It's in fourth order instead of second order. For that reason, it is small. But if there's no second order sequential process, then this is what you see, right? In this case, the current is mainly proportional to the number of electrons that can do that, and these are the electrons in the left lead between this energy, which is the Fermi level in the right lead, and the Fermi level in the left lead. And this number of electrons is proportional to the voltage splitting. For that reason, the current is proportional to the voltage, and one has linear behavior, or constant differential conductance. And now, if the energy is energy difference is large enough, then the same can happen, and also the electron can do an inelastic process and lose some energy to the local excitation. That opens new channels here and leads to a jump increase in the differential conductance, and the slope changes here increases also. So that's the main things you expect. Now let's look at a few experiments. This is an experiment on benzene dithiol between gold electrodes, and for that system the experiment found the current, a current which is this curve here, which is linear and then piecewise linear, and there were steps in the conductance, and the conductance is small compared to this quantum conductance E squared over H. So both suggest that what you see here is co-tunneling. There's no direct transition of the molecule in the relevant energy range, so only this fourth order process can take place. And then another example would be this here. This is tunneling through C60 between source and drain electrodes with the gate, and here you see steps in the current, somewhat smeared out, but clearly steps, and these steps, and at a small bias, you see essentially no current, so that looks like a Coulomb blockade, and the steps shift with the gate voltage here. So that's, it all suggests that we have sequential tunneling here. And, oh yes, so that was the current voltage characteristics. If you plot the differential conductance as this type of grayscale plot I showed before, you see some of the fine structure. You see here parallel sets of lines, and that was the characteristic of inelastic processes. And in this case, these lines here are attributed to this, to excitations of this particular vibrational mode of the C60. This attribution mainly comes from the energy. You can read off the energy here, it's 35 MeV, and that corresponds to this mode. This one, I think in this case I don't think that's really there. I mean, there are experiments where there is a gap in the center where the current is suppressed, but I'm not sure whether that applies here. Now, there are more of these plots, and sometimes there's a gap and sometimes there's none, so that's very sample dependent. So these plots also show these parallel lines, cannot see them very, very well here. In this case, you can even see several which are equidistant. So you can see the first few steps on the harmonic potential, harmonic oscillator ladder. And these are attributed to this mode. These have lower energy, and they probably correspond to a case, that's a different sample, when C60 is close to one of the electrodes and oscillates as a whole. relative to the electrode. Now, this is an experiment on magnetic or two different magnetic molecules. This, these organic ligands with cobalt. And first of all, one sees the same thing in the current voltage characteristics. There's the Coulomb blockade gap, and there are at least on one side clear steps, and they shift with gate voltage. So far, it's not much different from the C60. And also, there are some fine structure here in Coulomb diamonds attributed to vibrations. But in this case, there are these two lines here, which and the energy difference between them was found to increase linearly with magnetic field. You don't expect that for a vibration, of course. You expect that for a magnetic excitation. So what happens here is that the electron really interacts with the cobalt spin and does a spin flip on the cobalt. And that was for, there were two different molecules here, one with long legs and one with short legs, and this was the long-legged one. For the short-legged one, which has a stronger coupling to the leads, obviously, this experiment found a strong peak at zero bias, which would be here, so it's not diagonal, and this plot now would be horizontal. And this plot was strongly suppressed by increasing temperature, and it split by applied magnetic field, which both points in the direction that that's probably a Kondo peak. So this was interpreted as a Kondo effect in a single molecule. And there's another experiment in the same Nature paper, in the same issue of Nature, where they show also the Kondo effect for a different molecule. So that seems to be established. I showed it. Let's see, where is it? Sorry. I just showed that here. Right, this is the molecule. It has a cobalt ion inside. So the magnetic moment sits there. That's the last experiment I'm going to show. This is now also a magnetic molecule. It's more complicated. Manganese 12 acetate is a cluster of manganese, of 12 manganese ions with complicated organic ligands. The whole thing has a total spin of 10 in the neutral state, and it has a strong magnetic easy axis anisotropy. This large spin wants to point along the z direction, or minus z direction. That means that the energy is a function of magnetic quantum number. Looks like this. It has a high energy barrier. So the minus 10 and plus 10 states are preferred, and all the others are higher in energy. That experiment was done in Delft, in TU Delft, and Dan Ralph's group did a very similar experiment on another manganese 12 compound and also found this anisotropy. This anisotropy, I don't want to discuss that in detail at this point, leads to some rather complicated structure of this fine structure of the Coulomb diamonds. In particular, there are some regions, the black ones here, where the differential conductance is negative. That cannot be explained by this qualitative arguments I gave, right? So that's additional physics happening here. So here the current in fact decreases for increasing bias voltage. That means negative differential conductance. It's at least unusual, but I mean it's seen also in quantum dots. And now, let me come to the theory part. I want to study inelastic transport molecules, and in this case I'm going to talk about magnetic molecules. So the electrons tunnel to couple to the spin of a molecule. And if you want to use these magnetic molecules in molecule electronics as memory devices, you want to write the spin electronically. You want to if you have written it, you want to keep it, a certain decay rapidly, and you will want to read out the spin again. So these are some more technological applications of that. And the first molecule we looked at is endohedral N in C60. That means that there's a nitrogen atom sitting inside a C60 cage. Now this picture is for phosphorus, but it also works for nitrogen. And this material is produced by ion implantation of nitrogen or phosphorus into C60. And then the material is purified. By just ion implantation, you get about 10 to the minus 4 of the material implanted by nitrogen. So that's not a lot. But you can, by chemical means, you can purify it to nearly 100% endohedral C60. It's known that in this case the nitrogen retains its spin because it retains the 3 unpaired p electrons. So according to Hund's first rule, that gives the spin 3/2. And also, it's also known that the C60 has a threefold degenerate lowest unoccupied molecular orbital, or LUMO, which is the one where the physics is in this case. So we wrote down this simple model for this molecule. The first part here is the energy of the electrons in this threefold degenerate, or sixfold if you count spin orbital. And this energy can be shifted by the gate voltage, which is this. Excuse me. This is a Coulomb or Hubbard repulsion between electrons in this orbital. And this is an exchange interaction between the total spin of the electrons in this orbital, in these orbitals, and the spin of the nitrogen. And it's known from experiment that this is ferromagnetic, but it's not very well known what the value is. The leads are just described by a tight binding model, and the tunneling between leads and molecule is of the usual form, just second bilinear term in the fermion operators. And that makes up the total Hamiltonian of the system. And we use the density matrix formalism, which is standard, so I'll just go through it briefly so that you have some idea what's going on. Starts from the von Neumann equation for the density matrix, which when we write it in the interaction representation looks like this. The time derivative of the density matrix, the full density matrix, leads and molecule, is this commutator. And since it's the interaction representation with respect to the tunneling Hamiltonian, only that tunneling Hamiltonian appears here on the right hand side. This equation you can formally integrate, find this here. This doesn't help you normally because it just replaces the differential equation by an integral equation. However, now you can plug this equation into the first one and get this iterated, so to speak, von Neumann equation. And you could repeat that and go to arbitrary high order. And you see then already that you get something like an expansion in powers of the tunneling Hamiltonian by doing that. Now, we don't want to solve an equation for the total density matrix for molecule and leads because that's simply impossible. We want to reduce that to an equation only for the density matrix of the molecule. Since we have a relatively simple model, that reduced density matrix lives in a finite dimensional Hilbert space, and we can probably, if we have an equation, we can solve that numerically. And this reduced density matrix is defined just by taking the trace over all the states in the leads of the total density matrix. Now, to arrive at an equation for this reduced density matrix, one has to do a number of approximations. The first one is the Born approximation, which says that the density matrix at any time is just a product of density matrices of the molecule and density matrix of the leads, which is assumed to be in equilibrium. So this is just the Fermi distribution. And the second approximation is the famous Markov approximation, which says then if I plug that approximation into this equation here, then I get, then I have here still a density matrix at time t prime. And the Markov approximation says, well, the rate of change of the density matrix shouldn't really depend on what happened at times t prime before time t, but should only depend on the density matrix at that time t. So the system, really the leads, should not have memory. And that means I replace the density matrix at time t prime by the density matrix of t in this equation. And if I do that at this stage, so if I iterate that once and go to second order and then make this approximation, then I find an equation for the density matrix of the molecule, which is, of course, of second order in the tunneling Hamiltonian. And this is now a closed equation which I can solve. And if I go to higher order in this expansion, and this equation is still exact. So if I iterate that twice more and go to fourth order and then make this approximation, then I include co-tunneling processes, fourth order processes. I could go further if I want. So, but here it's only second order, so it's only sequential tunneling. Now, if I take that equation and transform back into the Schrödinger picture, it looks like this. Going back to the Schrödinger picture generates this term, which is just the unperturbed time evolution of the molecular reduced density matrix, and this is the second order perturbation from the hybridization or the hopping or the tunneling to the leads. And this technique has been used by many people in the context of molecules, for example by Mitra, Allain, and Millis. And this equation can now be evaluated. There are some alternative derivations which are in some sense more elegant, but not as easy to explain. For example, there's an elegant diagrammatic derivation using Keldysh formalism by Jürgen König et al. That was Jürgen König's diploma thesis, in fact. And there's a time convolutionless master equation, which means one can get a time local equation without making the Markov approximation. That's very interesting, and this has not been applied in the context of transport to molecules. And I'm going to do that, but I cannot say whether it's very useful.
Yeah. If I remember correctly, so Jürgen used this to study the Kondo effect in quantum.
Yeah. So among other things.
Still have Kondo effect in one approximation.
Oh no, he doesn't have to do that. I mean, okay. You don't, right? But if you do,
have you precluded the Kondo effect?
I have precluded the Kondo effect, definitely. But he didn't. So if you do that, if you use his approach and then make the same approximations, you get to the same equation. That's what I'm saying. So you can also use that to derive this. But you didn't make this approximation. You made another approximation to describe the Kondo effect. But that's all in questions of how to treat these equations. I mean, this diagrammatic expansion is still correct, exact. But then, I mean, you have to truncate that series in some way or resum part of it, and that's, of course, the problem. Okay, now, yes?
Okay. Bye-bye. Not getting the Kondo temperature correct somehow with the NTA type calculation. I mean, it's the same issue with the NTA.
Non-crossing approximation. Non-crossing approximation.
It's pretty much a collection of NTA things, but we can do some translations of all of those. There are different like one translation to another.
But it comes down to
Okay, so if we take this equation, now we could in principle solve this, okay? And the way we're doing is that is we're making one more approximation, which is we assume fast dephasing, which means that the off-diagonal components of this reduced density matrix decay rapidly. Then we are only left with the diagonal components of the density matrix, which are, of course, the probabilities of various molecular states. And for those probabilities, we find then this set of rate equations. And they are relatively easy to interpret. The rate of change of the probability to find the molecule in state N has two terms. One, the first one here describes transitions from states M into state N, and the second one transitions out of N to other states M, so in scattering and out scattering. And of course, the main work is in calculating these transition rates, and with these approximations here, we can do that. And this set of rate equations can be obviously written in the matrix form because it's linear. And especially, in particular, the stationary state, which is the one when the time derivatives all vanish, can be written in this way. So what that means is the stationary probability vector is just the eigenvector of this matrix with zero eigenvalue. So that's easier said than in fact calculated. So to numerically solve that is sometimes complicated because this matrix here contains these rates, and they span many orders of magnitude because they contain Boltzmann factors from energies. So just plugging that into a black box diagonalization routine usually fails. So one has to be careful in doing this numerical solution of this linear equation here. So, but we can handle that, and the results are here. Now for the stationary state, calculate the current as a function of voltage and find these nice steps. They are very sharp because the temperature is essentially zero for this calculation. And you see a small Coulomb blockade gap here. It's small because for the C60, the minus 1 and minus 2 charge states are nearly degenerate in contact to the metal. If you look closely at these steps, you see that they have a fine structure, and this fine structure is of course due to the magnetic interaction. Now we can also plot the differential conductance. This just shows how the steps in the current here shift with gate voltage, and you shouldn't believe that far out for large voltages because other things are bound to happen there. So this just shows kind of the topology of the this diagram. Now we look at some of these crossing points here in some more detail. Up here you see now that these lines really consist of have some fine structure due to magnetic interaction, but otherwise these crossing points are not particularly interesting because the lines just cross. If you look at crossing points at zero bias here, however, you find that the fine structure is becomes more interesting here. Some lines seem to flip over. And at zero bias, you only have a single crossing and not many crossings, like here. And also, this one in the middle also has some complicated structure. And of course, we want now to understand what that is. But let me first say that what we have here, in effect, is a map of all these possible crossover points. In experiment, it's usually not easy to determine what the charge states of the molecule actually are. You don't have independent measurement on that. But by measuring this fine structure and looking at our map, one could in principle determine which charge states one has. And I'm happy to say that Dan Ralph is planning to do an experiment like that on NNC60.
Can you see that the spin here is 3/2, that is N?
Can we see that the spin is 3/2? Yes, you can definitely. The number of lines depends on that. I'm going to explain that. So I want only. I said that we understand all the structure, and I want to discuss that for one particular case, which is the lower left of these crossing points. There's the figure again, and I will discuss the left-hand side. On the left-hand side, the ground state has one electron, and the first excited charge state has two. So the energy level scheme of the molecule looks like this. Here you have the charge one, or charge, and here you have the charge two states. For charge one, you have one electron, the spin 1/2, coupling to the nitrogen spin of 3/2, and you know what happens, you can combine them to a spin 1 or spin 2, and these two have different energies because of the exchange interaction, so this splits up. If you have two electrons, it gets more complicated, but can still discuss it by elementary quantum mechanics, and you find four states here with different energies. Now, let's say we are, the gate voltage is here, and we increase the bias voltage from zero. For small bias voltage, nothing happens because the energy is not large enough to excite any of these transitions. Or I should say the blue arrows here are transitions that are allowed in the sense that allowed for a single electron tunneling into or out of the molecule. For that kind of process, the occupation number changes by plus minus one, and the spin changes by plus minus 1/2, of course. So these are allowed single electron transitions.
What's the meaning of the doublet?
Sorry?
What's the meaning of the doublet?
I'm going to explain that in just a moment. Now, as I said, for small bias, nothing happens. Then at this particular bias, you have enough energy to excite this excitation here. And then you can go from charge 1 to charge 2, and this electron goes out on the other side, and you have a current. But you notice that this third dotted arrow here has a lower energy, so this arrow is in fact shorter than this one. But this one does not show up as a line here, it would be about here. The reason is that this doesn't start from the ground state, so the initial state of that one is not occupied, and for that reason it doesn't show at low temperatures. For the same reason, the other dotted transition also does not show, because it doesn't start from the ground state. That would be in this gap in between. The next one that does show is this, and this energy can excite this transition. But now you have get some probability in this state, and you have an allowed transition from here down here, and also from here up there. So at this point, you also excite these two transitions here, which are lower in energy, also become active because the initial states become occupied. So at the same, at this point, you switch on all three transitions, and you can see that by not just looking in this plot, but analyzing the actual height of this current step. So you open all the current conduction channels belonging to all three transitions. And then at the higher voltage here, you get this transition. This does not start from the ground state, but as I said, this state is now occupied with some probability, so this contributes. And finally, you find this one. This is the last one. You can, on the right-hand side, you can make the same kind of argument, but there are these charge 2 states are now below the charge 1 states. It changes the picture, but the arguments are the same. And in this crossing region here, these four states and these two states shift through each other as a function of gate voltage. And then for each gate voltage, you can again look at which transitions are allowed and so on, and you can attribute the transitions to all these lines you see in here if you want. Now, okay, let me come to another type of molecule. The NNC60 molecule is magnetically practically isotropic because it's a sphere, right? And now we have looked at magnetic molecules of magnetic anisotropy. For example, porphyrin rings with transition metal ions are a typical example, and also manganese 12 compounds. And we used a very simple model for this. This looks like the same model up to here, but here we only took a single orbital into account, so there's no degeneracy. And we added this thing, this easy axis anisotropy for the spin. K2 is the anisotropy energy, it's positive, and then it's an easy axis. So that means the spin wants to point in the plus or minus z direction. And this anisotropy means that there's now an energy barrier between spin up and spin down, like in the plot I showed before. And this leads to interesting new physics. It's rather clear that this energy barrier leads to slow relaxation. If you prepare the molecule in, let's say, a spin-up state, it will take long to go to a spin-down state if this energy barrier is high. And this is shown here. For small anisotropy, or zero, you just get this exponential decay of the magnetization, so that's the expectation value, or the average magnetization of the molecule, or an ensemble of molecules, one should say, is a function of time. Whereas for, if you increase the anisotropy at some point, it becomes much much slower, this relaxation at this value, you cannot see it. It's still exponential, but the time constant is very, very large. So what's going on? This is for a fixed bias voltage. So at that fixed bias voltage, what happens is for small anisotropy, this barrier is small, and there's enough energy to overcome that barrier. Okay? And as the anisotropy increases, at some this barrier becomes higher and higher, and at some value, 0.04 approximately, this transition here becomes energetically impossible, so the bias is no longer large enough to excite the electron from this state to that state. And then these excitations are only possible by thermal excitation, and that means they are exponentially suppressed. And for that reason, at around 0.04 for this anisotropy, the relaxation suddenly becomes much slower. And this very slow relaxation, I mean, that's a good thing, because if you want to do molecular electronics, we want slow relaxation of the spin. And this slow relaxation leads to another interesting result. Well, that's the same system, but now we consider a fixed anisotropy and vary the bias voltage. At very small bias voltage, you have some Coulomb blockade because you don't excite anything. And then we get this into this regime here. In this regime, the only allowed transition is between these two states here, the state with zero electrons and spin 2, and the state with one electron and spin 5 halves. We prepare the molecule in this state, 0,2. And then what can happen is an electron, a spin-up electron, can tunnel into the molecule, which increases the electron number by 1 and the spin by 1 half. And then we are here. And then the only thing that can happen is that the electron tunnels out again to the other lead, and we are back here. So the only transitions are between these two sides, these two molecular states, sorry. And that means that involves only spin-up electrons. A spin-down electron cannot tunnel onto the molecule, because that would be this transition. It would reduce the total spin by 1/2. And that's suppressed because it costs too much energy, and the bias voltage does not provide that energy. So the current is totally spin-polarized. And it remains totally spin-polarized until the molecule relaxes and loses its preferred magnetization. But that, as I said, is an exponentially slow process. So after an exponentially long time, the molecule will become, on average, unpolarized, and the current will also become unpolarized. So if I integrate the transferred spin over time, I find the spin accumulation in the leads, right? And it is finite, because after a certain time, the molecule does relax into a average non-magnetic state, but it's very, very large. And so the result of that is, very spin-polarized current. The result of that is you get a macroscopic spin accumulation in the leads, and that's only controlled by the initial state of the quantum spin on the molecule. So the sign of the spin accumulation in the leads depends on the sign of the spin on the molecule, and that means we have proposed amplifier for the spin. And that looks like a good readout mechanism for this molecular spin, because this macroscopic spin accumulation is hopefully much easier to detect than the orientation of a single quantum spin of a molecule. Also, let me just mention, without going into the details, that this anisotropy also leads to negative differential conductance. Due to the anisotropy, one finds now also fine structure of the Coulomb block, Coulomb diamonds, which is even more complicated. And in some regions, there's negative differential conductance. I don't want to discuss that in detail. Let me just come to the last part, which is we take the same type of magnetically anisotropic molecule, and but now we assume that one of the leads is ferromagnetic and the other is non-magnetic. Why would we do that? The reason is we would want to switch the molecule into a certain state. So we want to write the spin, not only read the spin. Of course, you can do that by applying a magnetic field, but that's not a practicable idea, because you need a huge field and you need fine-tuning, and applying a huge field to a single molecule is, of course, hard, and changing a huge magnetic field is slow, so it's much better to do it without magnetic field, and you can do it with a ferromagnetic lead. Just to give you the idea, here we have a non-magnetic and here we have a ferromagnetic lead, and for the sake of simplicity, let's assume that it's a half-metallic ferromagnet which only has density of states for spin up. If we can also have some density of states for spin down, it just changes the results in the expected way, right? So, but it's easier to discuss with if it only has spin up. So if the current is flowing from the ferromagnet to the non-magnet, then it's kind of obvious that you only get spin up electrons onto the molecule, and it's clear that they, with some probability, will flip the spin up. So by passing a current in this direction, you can flip the spin up from down to up. But it also works in the other direction. If you apply the bias in the reverse direction, and you tunnel and spin down, spin up electron tunnels in this direction, nothing happens. But if you spin down electron tunnels, the spin down electron cannot go into the ferromagnet directly, because there's no density of states, but it can flip the spin and then go. But for the electron to flip up, the molecular spin has to go down by one unit. So this process reduces the molecular spin. So by passing the current in this direction, you reduce the molecular spin. And we have calculated that in some detail. So this is probability to find the molecule in certain charge and spin states as a function of time. And we've proposed protocols of how to write the spin. And I don't want to discuss that in detail. I just wanted to make clear that this works. What's more interesting, perhaps, is this, still for the same system. We found the following result, which at first we found surprising. This is now for vanishing anisotropy, because anisotropy doesn't play much of a role here. This shows the current as a function of voltage for certain parameters. What you see is, for small voltage, again, you have Coulomb blockade, there's no current, and then the current increases, as you expect when you come to the edge of the Coulomb blockade regime. But then we found it goes to the maximum and decreases again to something which is nearly zero, but not quite. And this is due to spin blockade, as I'm going to discuss. And of course, this decrease of current with voltage here is negative differential conductance. So in this case, we have a huge regime of negative differential conductance. And also, I want to point out that this is not a low temperature effect now. This outermost curve here is for room temperature, basically. So that's interesting. If it can be shown in an experiment. Now, can we understand that? In the Coulomb blockade regime, the voltage is so small, again, that no transitions are allowed except by thermal excitation, and you find a suppressed current. That's nothing new. So this is the energy scheme, energy versus magnetic quantum number. Now, these states are all degenerate because the anisotropy is zero. There's no barrier. These states, these five states, or should say that we assumed for no good reason that the spin is 2 of this local moment. So these five here are states with zero electrons on the molecule, and these are all states with one electron on the molecule, and they split into a quartet and a sextet because of the exchange interaction between the electron and the local spin. Okay, so what happens if the voltage is here? So if we are in this spin blockade regime, let's say we start with zero electrons, then a spin up electron or a spin down electron can tunnel into the molecule, and that would increase or decrease the total spin by 1/2. These are the green and blue arrows. Both are allowed. There's nothing special about this. Then we have a molecule with one electron, but now the spin up electron can tunnel out into the right electrode, but the spin down cannot. And that means spin up electron tunneling out means this total spin decreases by 1/2. That's the blue arrow. No, sorry. That's the green arrow down, right? You go from charge 1 to charge 0. So these transitions are allowed. However, transitions against the blue arrow are not allowed, because that would mean we go from one electron to 0, electron goes out, and increase the magnetic quantum number by 1/2. That means spin out, spin down goes out, but it cannot, because there's this ferromagnet here. So this direction of transition, the yellow one here, is forbidden, or at least suppressed by density of states in the ferromagnetic lead. And that means that if we start by in any of these states and just let the system develop in time, it will perform some kind of random walk between these states, but it will end up eventually in this state because it is trapped there, it cannot go out again. And then the molecule has maximum negative spin, and since it cannot go out again, it remains with charge 1 and no current can flow anymore. So this we call spin blockade, because spin blockade in general means that current is suppressed because the transitions that would allow current are forbidden by spin conservation. And that's the case here. So to summarize, I started out by saying that thinking about molecular electronics means that motivates the study of inelastic transport through single molecules, and I showed a number of results for the theory of that transport, and the main points were that the coupling of the electrons to the spin leads to certain fine structure of the current voltage characteristics or differential conductance, which one can understand. Then looking at molecules with magnetic anisotropy, we find slow relaxation because of energy barrier, and because of that we find the effect of giant spin amplification. And if we then assume that one lead is ferromagnetic, we can also devise schemes to write the spin, not only to read it, and we find the spin blockade. Finally, let me say that this work was done together with very good master students I had before I came to Kansas, and was done in the group of Felix von Oppen, and we discussed a lot with him, and also with Jens Koch, who is another very good graduate student, and with Wolfgang Harnight, who is an experimentalist working with this endohedral NNC60, and it was supported by the German Science Foundation. Thank you. What do you mean, this and that? Oh yeah, it's the reason is that in this case we assume that the spin down density of states here is only 1% of the spin up density of states. We get this very low residual current from the spin down. So that's not realistic. So if you have iron or something with 50% density of states, then this would only go up to here and would no longer be symmetric. It would also become asymmetric if, for example, if you introduce anisotropy, or when the charge 2 states, which are now up here somewhere, go down. And that all these cases is not that nice.
Looks a little bit similar to the spin blockade which has been described as
right? Yeah, I mean there are different kinds of spin blockade, but I think the common element is that, as I said, spin conservation, cases where spin conservation suppresses the current, and that is one different example. Yes, but I mean that interaction is typically very small, so that's a question of energy scales, I would say, because you want the temperature to be smaller than that coupling to see it.
But the quantum dots is also strong because you have so many of them.
Oh yes. Oh, that's right. No, I haven't thought about that. Yeah. If you have all of them aligned,
you know that even if they're not aligned, you have always the square root n of these with r aligned.
Oh yes. Yeah, if you have enough, then that could strong, that could be measurable, yeah.
Yeah, but you don't have it here, right?
I don't have these. In this case, no, definitely. In this case, I have only a handful. In this case, I can forget it. No, but I agree that for a quantum dot, it's certainly important. Yeah.
So you assume some value of the massage piece and some value of the effect. How does that compare to the experimental massage piece?
It's the same order of magnitude, and the effects, the qualitative effects, are robust. I mean, the details shift. For example, this fine structure here.
It's a reasonable isotope.
Yeah. I mean, what this always looks like that. And if you increase or decrease the anisotropy, it just blows up or shrinks that picture. But yeah, the value we used was not totally unreasonable.
Parameters in your model, they are just fitting parameters.
Yes, the anisotropy part we didn't even fit it, right? We just wanted to find out the qualitative kinds of behavior to expect. We didn't try to describe a particular molecule yet.
Principles calculations, like quantum chemistry calculations, which you calculate everything exactly to, or not exactly, but sort of and then you know what number.
Yes, you can. I mean, I'm
vehicle rates or something like that.
Yeah, right. I'm collaborating with perhaps you know her, Ingrid, you probably not know her. Mertich also was here, and we are collaborating on transport through benzene vanadium wires, which so they are benzene rings and then a vanadium atom, and that repeats with exactly that goal. Yes. It can be, yeah, that's fine.
You do this for spin orbit interaction.
No, I mean,
I'm doing it at all. I think Mertich does not do it with an orbit interaction yet.
Spin orbit interactions is easier, I guess, to do that is what you
understand, right? Yeah. Calculating realistically the anisotropy is tricky. Because it's a very small difference in the total energy, so
that's a point.